Okay, before we move on with our exploration of the teachings of Atisha, and we're going to hopefully get to Geshe Drom today, are there any questions from yesterday? Yes.
I heard you talking about sustainable practice and the consciousness, particularly the consciousness of practice. And in the first five elements, you use your imagination to work your way through it. How would you approach the last element? Would you approach it as you would just sitting or?
Bhante's always been. So the six element practice is a practice that we do in the order, but. You can read about it, I think, in different places, and sometimes you can get introduced to it before you're ordained. I think we have done it on some going for refuge retreats as well. But one of the things that Bhante has said over the years that in the state of consciousness, he doesn't want there to be too much speculation. It's more that you, as it were, let go. And that really all the work gets done in the stages preceding that, and in the last stage to do with consciousness, you're just allowing yourself to experience an unfolding consciousness, as it were, that's expanding, but you're not speculating about it. You don't set up a lot of mental chat about the consciousness stage. It's more one of the ways that it has been described, that the element practice is a sort of purification practice. You're purifying yourself, particularly of attachment and identification with the, as it were, physical elements. And in doing that, you experience a greater purity of consciousness. So it's more you just allow yourself to open up to that. Of course, it really does depend on all the other practices you're doing: mindfulness, metta, puja, devotion, ethics, generosity, as well as the preceding stages of that practice. If it's not happening in with that context, you're not going to get very far with it. Yeah, it's very, very important. Okay. Any other things?
I struggle with understanding voidness, the essence of voidness.
Right. Well, that's very good that you struggle with it. I'm really, really pleased that you struggle to understand it, because only too easily people have a very superficial understanding of these matters. And much better to not understand it than to have a wrong understanding of it. There's a famous saying, I think it's of Nagarjuna: much better to have a view of self as high and as vast as Mount Meru than a wrong understanding of voidness. Because a wrong understanding of voidness usually is associated with nihilism, that you think that nothing, there's no reality to anything. If there's no reality to anything, it doesn't matter what you do. There are no values to live by. You live, you die. That's it. Nothing has any meaning. Nothing has any value. If you take the teaching of emptiness and voidness in that way, you're really stuck, because you've turned the medicine of a teaching into poison. And the poison is that you don't see any meaning in the Dharma. You don't see any point to life. And this seems to have been a real problem in Indian Buddhism, hence this particular saying. And it's very interesting that the image is used of Mount Meru, because Mount Meru is the central mountain. It's the centre of the cosmos. So in a way, what it's saying, well, much better to have a sense that you are the centre of everything, rather than that nothing matters. Because if you think that you're the centre of anything, of everything, that's good, because that's the starting point of your practice. Because what you need to start doing is to wake up to the fact that everybody else regards themselves as the centre of everything. So if you have a sense of your own centrality and importance, and that you're very, very important to yourself. You're very, you know, and life is very, very important to you. That's a great way of learning how to identify with others. So in my practice, I might, for example, think, well, Lawrence, in the same way that I regard myself as the centre of everything and being very important to myself and wanting myself to be well and wanting myself to avoid suffering and to feel protected and okay, Lawrence feels exactly the same. I might not know Lawrence very well, but I know that fact I know about him because, you know, he's very important to himself as I'm important to myself. So you use that to meditate. You use that to identify with others. And curiously enough, this is one of the ways in which you can realize emptiness. Because in doing that, you start to realize that in fact, there's no real difference between you and others. We're exactly the same in this respect. We want to avoid suffering. We want to be happy. And in fact, Shantideva uses this meditation quite profoundly, where he says, well, stop thinking that you're separated out from everything else. Think of all beings as being part of one great body, and you need to protect all of them. That is actually the key to emptiness, because what it's doing, that kind of meditation, it's freeing you up from an excessive self-identification. Do you see what I mean? It's very clever. These Buddhist masters, they're so clever the way they meditate on these things. They're using that very, very important sense of self-cherishing to undo a sense of separation. Do you see what I mean? So it's good that you don't understand voidness. Perhaps it would be better that we start off by developing a provisional, very, very positive sense of self-cherishing. Use that to identify with the self-cherishing in others. Develop metta for everybody. And then, down the road, we realise, well, hello, there isn't really any permanent, fixed and separate self in any of this. Everything, therefore, is voidness. Do you see what I mean? But you're doing it within the context of giving people value. I think the great danger with teachings like shunyata, not self, in the West, we see them as value-free insights. And hence you have nihilism. And that is a profound, a terrible, almost evil misunderstanding of what these great teachers are talking about. You know, in some ways I wish they'd never taught it. Because for the West, it becomes too easily poison. When in fact, the teaching is all about how to remove, how to break down the separation between self and other. The result should be, if you really do see emptiness, is a very strong sense of the common humanity of everybody, of realizing that we are profoundly the same, profoundly interconnected, yes, distinctive and different and all that, but profoundly the same, so that we then behave to people with great loving kindness. You know, if you like, we're seeing that another way you could talk about the realization of emptiness is seeing that there is just life. There is just life. I don't want to say all life is one, because that can be misunderstood. But there is just life, and your life is no more superior to anybody else's life, or any animal's life, or any plant's life, if you like. You know, there's that sense of the commonality of life, so that you then behave with loving kindness and cherishing and reverence to all life. I think that's the real meaning of voidness. I think that's, that's where that insight leads to. And I think we're on much better ground if we think of it like that. I was very, very struck and almost shocked when I saw a YouTube talk by this rather eccentric Slovenian philosopher named, is it Zizek? And he was talking about Western Buddhism. I don't know who he'd encountered, but he mentioned the boss of one of the great big global companies. And this particular boss said he was a Buddhist, he did meditation. I don't know what sort of Buddhist or what sort of meditation he did, maybe some Tibetan form, I don't know. But he said, the thing that this CEO said, that this big director said, was that Buddhism is brilliant. It's perfect. Because Buddhism teaches the provisionality, the ephemeral nature of all things, because it's teaching that everything is flux, this is perfect for us, because that's the market. That's what the market is like. There's nothing substantial in the market. So this is brilliant. You're getting a training in meditation so that you can play the market really well. This is a perversion of Buddhism. This is taking a teaching and using it for something entirely different from what it's meant for. And divorcing it from its context. If you really did see Shunyata, you'd have a critique of the very nature of capitalism, global capitalism and the market. You would have a critique of that kind of materialism. You would be approaching it quite differently. It's been well rehearsed that there's a famous book called Zen at War, which is really quite shocking, the way in which Zen practitioners in Japan gave sort of Buddhist philosophical background to the Japanese war effort and nationalism. You know, the sort of thing that when you kill someone, the act of killing is empty, the person is empty, I am empty, so who is killed? It's all illusion. Again, that's a terrible perversion of these teachings, and you can see why, you know, the tradition, this tradition especially, is very, very concerned to say you cannot divorce emptiness from ethics, you cannot divorce emptiness from compassion, from love, and any attempt to do so is leading you into perdition, is leading you to downfall. So does that help you to... I've gone off on one, but... perhaps the language of emptiness, of not-self, because it's a negating language, it leads to problems for us, because I think one of the main problems in the modern West is that people find it, you know, they don't have confidence to sort of positively believe in anything, to have values, to really see that there is an order to existence, that there is the law of karma, that there is the dharma, that there is a path, that ethics matter, and so on. So in some ways, it's not a helpful teaching. It's there. We have to do something with it. But we have to realize it's there to realize, well, I'm going to say it, the oneness of life, the oneness of human beings, the oneness of all things. Not in a sort of, I don't mean that in a sort of philosophical way. I'm not getting Vedantic. I mean in an ordinary, straightforward human way. You know, that when you're with people, there are no barriers to your experience of the living beingness of them. And all you want to do is to assist in their human flourishing. That's what the real experience of living the path of emptiness really is. Nothing other than that. Yeah? Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Any others? Okay, well then that's good. You've opened up something, because at the end there we had the terrible doubt of appearances yesterday, didn't we? And dear old Walt. Then Atisha says something, gives a beautiful description of what happens. So he says, therefore, when you realize the correct meaning of voidness, it is just like the solitary heroic medicine, for all the path is included in that realization. The disciples ask, how do you include the entire path within the realization of voidness? Atisha, all the path is included in the six transcendences. When you realize the correct meaning of voidness and lose your blind lust for all things material and spiritual, your life becomes one flowing act of transcendent giving. In the absence of attachment, you are no longer defiled by non-virtuous deeds, and you enter the ever-flowing harmony of transcendent moral practice. In this freedom from defilement, you also liberate yourself from the passionate domination of I and mine, and attain the ever-flowing transcendent patience. As you take great pleasure in the realization of voidness, your life becomes one ever-flowing transcendent effort. Through this, you lose all your attraction to objects and enter the ever-flowing transcendent meditation. And finally, when your mind is freed from the habit of seeing everything through the prism of three aspects, you will attain the ever-flowing transcendent wisdom. So, he's talking about the paramitas, but the paramitas or perfections or transcendences, these are the classic bodhisattva practices that he practices on a heroic scale. But he's talking about them here not as something we're making an effort to practice, but as the expression of the realization of voidness or the realization of emptiness and the essence of emptiness and compassion. So in a way, it's underlining what I've said earlier. You can tell if there's some sort of sense of voidness in somebody, some sense of realization, if you observe that they're just flowing along with generous activity, that they're giving of themselves all the time. Walt Whitman again: when I give, behold, I do not give lectures and a little charity. When I give myself. There's just this, the whole life is one of generosity, and particularly in this context, the concern to bring the Dharma to people, being generous with the Dharma, not holding back on the Dharma, seeing your practice as a way of giving the Dharma. That's the sign of real non-attachment. Real non-attachment is, what it looks like, is generosity, and so on. Just picking out a few things here. I love this one. As you take great pleasure in the realization of voidness, your life becomes one ever-flowing transcendent effort. So there's pleasure in the realization of emptiness. It's blissful. It's ecstatic. You know, when you see through all the sort of fixity of things, and out of that pleasure comes energy. Perhaps effort isn't the right word. Perhaps it's better. There's just this free-flowing energy, you know, in your life that's very, very pleasurable. You know, if we're making heavy weather of our life, of our Dharma practice, it means there's something a bit missing. Something isn't quite as it should be. We haven't sort of freed ourselves up enough, and we need to look into that a bit. And being free from the prism of the three aspects means that you don't have any sort of unhelpfully self-conscious view of being an actor, of acting, and who you act in relation to. So if you're giving, you don't have a sense, I am giving this to them. The giving, everybody else sees that there is tremendous sort of giving going on, but the bodhisattva doesn't think of it like that. It's just the natural expression of their being. They're just so absorbed in what they're doing. There is this sort of natural sort of activity. There isn't anything self-conscious about it. They don't have any sense of attainment and non-attainment, of being a bodhisattva, of not being a bodhisattva. They're just, as it were, swimming in the ocean of the Dharma, happily. Of course, to get to that, we need particular practices, and you can use the paramitas as a path of practice, generosity, ethics, and so on. It's a discipline for us at first. But there comes a point where it's the natural expression of our being, you know, a point very long down the road. You know, it's said similarly of the precepts, that the Buddha naturally behaves according to the precepts. He doesn't have to think about practicing the precepts. The precepts are the full expression of his realization. That's why we practice the precepts. We're sort of modelling ourselves on the Buddha's natural behaviour. Same way with the paramitas. If we really want to be a bodhisattva, well, we do the paramitas, the perfections, as a discipline, in order to realise that is to become one day it being the natural expression of our being. That's the aim of Buddhist practice, Buddhist discipline. Another way you could look at it is I think using sort of creative sort of metaphors. You know, Bantu said, well, a bodhisattva is a bit like an artist being completely absorbed in the act of creation, you know, with their materials, whether it's painting or music or sculpting or writing. There's complete absorption in the creative act. Well, a bodhisattva, well, it might be an artist bodhisattva, but it's going to be particularly with people, with life itself. They're totally absorbed in that activity. Whether there are difficulties, whether it's easy, they don't mind. They're just absorbed in this practice of the paramitas, or this expression of the paramitas, the ever flowing. It's a lovely phrase. That's what we're aiming for. That's what we're looking for. And it's good to notice those moments. And of course, you'll probably only notice them retrospectively, or out of the corner of your eye, as it were. Those moments where it really did flow. You know, where your meditation flowed, or your generosity flowed, or your ethics flowed, or whatever it might be, or your energy flowed. And you think, gosh, there's something going on there. You know, I wasn't trying, and it was happening. Very, very precious times to notice, I think. This is a bit related, I think, to, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if you've read that very important paper, one of the seven papers that Subhuti wrote after having meetings with Bhante. There's the one on the suprapersonal force, you know, where Subhuti really tries to get inside, you know, Bhante's description of particularly that experience of communicating the Dharma in Nagpur after Dr. Ambedkar's death, where Bhante gave all those lectures going from one place to another, and he had a sense of being in samadhi, that there was just this impersonal force, just, you know, his experience of himself was most peculiar, he said. He just felt he was an impersonal force. The Dharma was just flowing through, and I remember him saying to me, long before that paper was written, that he sort of noticed that and realised that if he'd stopped to think about it, that the energy would stop. So there was an awareness in the moment of it happening, and at the end of giving all those lectures, he felt really refreshed. So it can be like that sometimes in our life and in our practice. The more you sort of loosen yourself up through Buddhist training, the more you can open up to forces that are, as it were, greater than yourselves. Okay, I think we ought to get a bit practical now, if we haven't already. So what I want to do is to jump to Geshe Drong, Atisha's great disciple. And so this is Geshe Drong on how to attain the essence of voidness and compassion, Shunyata Karuna Garbha. So We'll just go through this. Probably won't get through it all this morning. Let's just go through this. If you can find it, it's a few pages on in your text. Geshe Drong on how to attain the essence of voidness and compassion. So after Atisha passed into Parinirvana, the teacher Drong became his successor. At one time, his three disciples, the brothers Potowa, Chengawa, and Puchungwa, asked Geshe Drong, "Please tell us the method of practice which includes the essence of all the paths to omniscient Buddhahood." Again, the question, what is the essence of all the paths? Geshe Drong's getting the same question as his own teacher from his own direct disciples. They want to hear from him how he sees things on this occasion. And Geshe Drom follows on from his teacher, but also elaborates. Although there are an inconceivable number of precepts, each of which is an entrance to the path of enlightenment, very important detail, an inconceivable number of precepts, each of which is an entrance to the path of enlightenment, there is, for one who has the necessary foundation for practice, only one thing to be obtained. You have to remember when these teachers speak like this, it is sort of a bit rhetorical. You know, on this occasion, you know, he's talking to these men at this time. So there's one thing to be obtained. It could be on another occasion, he might also say, there is only one thing to be obtained. You have to do this sometimes when you're communicating the Dharma to people. You have to really get them to listen up. You have to say, there's only one thing you actually need. And of course, the next day you say, there is only one thing you actually need, which might be a bit different from the day before. But anyway, so take that one thing very seriously today and tomorrow and the next day. There's only one thing. After one has the necessary foundation for practice. I think foundation for practice, I suspect, what Geshe Drom is getting at is renunciation and going for refuge. You know, the necessary foundation for practice is that he's just passing over this. You need to be committing yourself to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You need to have decided on a particular path, a particular approach. You need to have decided that you're going away from worldly attitudes into the Dharma. That's, I suspect, what he means by the necessary foundation. What is that one thing, the three brothers asked? Here it is again. Possession of the essence of voidness and compassion. Let me explain this. Voidness is the absolute bodhicitta. It is the realization that all phenomena are primordially unborn. Compassion is the conventional bodhicitta. It is great compassion generated to all living beings. All living beings who have not yet realized the unborn nature of all phenomena. Therefore, those who practice the Mahayana path should first make effort in the method of generating these two aspects of bodhicitta. Once the bodhicitta with its two aspects has arisen, it should be diligently practiced. By doing this, one is certain to actualize the Rupakaya and the Dharmakaya, the ultimate fruits of achieving both aspects of bodhicitta. I mean, you can see these boys, these men, these great men, they really do pack a lot of Dharma into a few words. I mean, some of these terms, you'd have to do a series of lectures over many weeks to really get even near to understanding them, and we don't have that sort of time. So he's explaining the possession of the essence of voidness and compassion. Ultimately, of course, they're not separable. That's why Bhante says the essence of voidness is compassion and the essence of compassion is voidness. They're not to be separated. But because of our own dualistic nature, they're divided and we have to kind of work on both of these aspects in our practice. So in explaining this, he says voidness is the absolute bodhicitta. It is the realization that all phenomena are primordially unborn. So much in there. Primordially unborn. So the word for unborn is anutpatika, which can also mean unarisen, unproduced. So this is a weird one because we're told that everything is a dependent arising, aren't we? Everything is conditioned co-production. But what seems to have happened with the Mahayana, they seem to feel that one of the problems, one of the things that happened, yes, we say that everything is arising independent upon conditions. If you take that too literally, you can think of things arising independent upon conditions. They're saying, actually, if you really analyse, if you really look, you won't find anything that has arisen. So everything is unarisen. I mean, it seems sort of bizarre, isn't this just sort of a logic chopping? But perhaps it's not. Perhaps there's a great sort of shock value in just hearing this statement, the realization that all phenomena, all things, all dharmas are primordially unborn. You know, it's quite good fun to go around thinking, well, actually, you know, all you lot are primordially unborn. It sort of challenges the kind of, you know, usual way we go about things. Because, you know, you all obviously are there. You're all obviously appearing to me, looking at me. I'm talking to you. But then, you know, they've come along and said, well, actually, all of us are primordially unborn. I think I'm actually not going to say very much about it, but it's interesting the imagery, if you think of the imagery and metaphors that are used to describe this, perhaps they get us nearer to what this kind of realization might be. They use the imagery of Maya, everything is like a magical illusion, an apparition. So yes, there's appearance, but that you won't find anything sort of substantial in that appearance that you can finally grab and get hold of. It's this wonderful sort of magical display. But other imagery is used as well, like a bubble or the previous moment of a ball of foam. I really like that one. So you're all previous moments of balls of foam. Well, previous moments of balls of foam aren't there, and yet there is a ball of foam. Or a lightning flash is another one. A lightning flash, that everything is like a lightning flash. There's this, you sort of see something incredibly impressive, which seems to have this tremendous effect, but you can't grasp hold of it. You can't get it. You can't sort of have it. So the whole idea of this, again, is that the whole sort of sense of it, in some traditions, they bring out the wonder of things. What this should be resulting in is a sense of wonder, a sense of wonder of existence. If we think of things existing, they can seem very sort of tired and old. We can feel very tired and old sometimes. But this is, if you're saying everything is unarisen, primordially unborn, actually everything is new, everything is fresh, and the consciousness that's engaging with it is fresh and alive. So that perhaps gets us a bit closer to what this might be all about. Anyway, you can nut away at this in your study groups and ask your study group leaders for the real meaning of this. You know, you've got all these, you know, suritas, a Manjugosha practitioner, he'll be able to answer. Dharmadipa and Bodhicitta are full of sort of transcendental insights, so they'll be able to answer. And you know, I'm sure the other study group leaders will be able to give a good account of themselves as well. Manjusia, Paraga, and you know, you'll be fine with them. They know more about this topic than I do. You know, I'm just adding flowers to brocade. Anyway, but there's this word paramata. Voidness is the absolute bodhicitta. So absolute is a translation of this word paramata. Now, again, I think Westerners, perhaps even Easterners too, when you hear a word like absolute, you think, well, that's the one I really want, compared with the conventional. Oh, that must be really lower and lesser. I want the absolute. We're so ambitious, you know, us lot. You know, we want the ultimate, the absolute, the real thing. Very, very unfortunate sort of way of thinking. Paramata is arta means meaning. Para here means something like ultimate or final or perfected. So it's the ultimate and final meaning, if you like, or the perfect meaning. The bodhicitta of ultimate meaning. The bodhicitta of ultimate. And bodhicitta, of course, is the enlightened consciousness. And actually, they always insist in the tradition that the ultimate meaning of bodhicitta cannot be articulated. So even to say that it's the realization that everything is unborn is wrong. It's false. It really cannot be put into any language. You know, I don't know if you remember Bhante's lecture on the bodhicitta in that series on the aspects of the bodhisattva ideal. He said, the word bodhicitta is not a good word for the bodhicitta, because the tradition is insistent that the bodhicitta cannot be put into any kind of condition construction. It's not part of the five skandhas. It's not part of any aspect of conditioned existence. It's not to be articulated. It's profound, sublime, beyond language, beyond self, beyond other. So in a sense, to think in terms of I'm really interested in the absolute is completely ridiculous, completely nonsensical, because you're turning something into an object which is beyond subject and object. It's much better to think, to come down as it were, or to move back to, or to really meditate on this meaning of the Sanvritti bodhicitta, which is here translated as the conventional bodhicitta. Again, this word conventional is unfortunate, because when we hear the word conventional, we think sort of straight, ordinary, dull. You know, why do you want to be conventional? Why do you want the conventional bodhicitta? Don't you want the really authentic bodhicitta? The ultimate edgy bodhicitta? Why do you want the conventional one? It's sometimes called relative bodhicitta. Well, why do you want relative? Who's interested in relativity? I mean, that sounds so dull and ordinary. Sanvritti is actually a word very hard to translate from the Sanskrit. I've done a bit of investigation into the meaning of Sanvritti. And I think one of the best ways of translating it is what the bodhicitta looks like in ordinary everyday reality. I think that's the best meaning of it. What it actually looks like. Of course, what it looks like is love, is compassion, is generosity, is selfless service, living the Dharma life in its fullest. That's what it actually looks like. The Buddha's wisdom looks like compassion in reality. That non-dual, unconditioned, inexpressible reality looks like love, compassion, generosity, patience, energy in ordinary everyday life. That's what the real meaning of the Sanvritti Bodhicitta is. And when you start to open up to that, or try to imitate that, I mean that positively, aspire to that, what starts to happen, you realise that it just has immense depth that you cannot actually articulate, that you cannot put into words, that you cannot finally describe. And then you're getting a sense of what the Paramatta bodhicitta really is. It's like the metta bhavana sometimes. You struggle away at metta, and you think, crikey, this is metta bhavana. And then one day, something happens where love really opens up. You know, a love which doesn't seem to have any limits. And you realise, actually, to call it metta isn't the right way of describing it. That's just a word. That doesn't describe what this really is. I don't know what this is. It's extraordinary. It's sublime. And then, of course, once you start thinking about it, you come back to where you usually are. Do you see what I mean? Do you see what I'm sort of getting at with this business of Paramatta and Sanvritti? So, in a way, I'm coming back to this point. The best thing to concentrate on is the Sanvritti bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, what it actually looks like in everyday life, which is, yes, love, compassion, generosity, the other Brahma Viharas, practicing the Dharma, practicing the ordinary wisdom teachings. Forget about the unborn, unarisen things. Concentrate on impermanence. Concentrate on all that. Yes, maybe you'll have glimpses of that bottomless depth of the Paramatta Bodhicitta. And when that happens, that will inform, you know, what you're doing in your ordinary life. That will give it greater sort of depth and meaning. But you need to concentrate in terms of day-to-day practice on that ordinary, everyday stuff. And it leads to, says Geshe Drom, It leads to these two aspects of bodhicitta, leads to the rupakaya and dharmakaya. So this again is incredible, and I find this extraordinarily inspiring. You know, the rupakaya, of course, means the form body of the Buddha. The dharmakaya is the body of reality. So the emptiness, the unarisen, the unborn, that aspect of things leads to that dimension of Buddhahood, which we designate dharmakaya, which is the Buddha always in touch with reality, the profound reality of things. The rupakaya is that manifesting concretely in life. It could be the rupakaya in the form of a human form. In the case of, you can see that very clearly in the life of the Buddha. Or the rupakaya can also have this aspect of the sambhogakaya, that dimension of the Buddha which, for want of a better way of putting it, is archetypal. So this is all where all the wonderful sort of imagery is, that sort of dimension of enlightenment, which is beautiful, rapturous, and so on. That aspect, that dimension of enlightenment, very profound way of talking about things. Now, the thing about this is, the one of the things I like about this is that it's making it clear, using this language of kaya, which can be provisionally translated as body, it's making it clear that gaining progress on the path is embodied. It doesn't remain merely mental. And sort of, again, one of the big problems, I think, of Buddhism in the West, it's so mental. It's so much to do with sort of head. What we're looking for is the full embodiment of Dharma practice in all aspects of our behaviour. And according to the Mahayana, they're very clear. You live this life properly, one day you're going to have an entirely different body. You'll be a Buddha with all the major marks and signs, with all the sort of qualities manifesting in you. And even your very appearance to people will be a teaching, will bring them on the path to Buddhahood. I know it might sound like science fiction, but I find it tremendously inspiring to think of it like that. That we're, as it were, our Dharma life is about creating a different body in time, over time, a different kind of embodiment even. But then Geshe Drom becomes very, very practical. So he's given us the vision of what we're aiming for, the two kinds of bodhicitta, which leads to Buddhahood in the fullest sense, and then he comes down to earth. There are many methods of generating the two aspects of bodhicitta. Should they be condensed into a way of practice, there are no more than three root methods, and sprouting from these, nine principal branch methods. The three root methods are: 1, mind training; 2, gathering the accumulations of merit and wisdom; and 3, the search for samadhi. Each root method has three principal branch methods. So the three principal branch methods of mind training are: 1, meditation on impermanence; 2, cultivation of loving kindness and compassion; and 3, meditation on the selflessness of all persons and phenomena. Among the various methods of mind training, these three are the only important ones. All others are included within them. Geshe Drom's really, really laying it down, isn't he, on what's important. So let's just look a little bit at the first of this. First of all, there's this mind training, which is probably a translation of the Tibetan lojong, which also means mind purification, heart transformation, attitude transformation, and of course we've got these very famous mind training texts, like the 8 verses of mind training and the 7-point mind training. There's many of them, and Geshe Drom is in that tradition. The first thing that needs to be said, having, you know, had a go at the mind, we also need to make it very central. Real Dharma practice is all about mind training. The mind is the forerunner of everything, as in the first 2 verses of the Dhammapada, which I'm sure you can all remember, that the consciousness, the kind of consciousness that we have, the kind of mind that we have, whether it's skillful, whether it's unskillful, that is going to lead to particular effects, whether happy effects for self and others, or unhappy, suffering effects for self and others. The first 2 verses of the Dhammapada are absolutely clear about this. We need to pay attention to our minds. Our minds are absolutely central. We need to take responsibility for our consciousness, because it's our consciousness that determines our being and our world. It's not to say that we're not affected by the world around us. Of course we are, very powerfully. Circumstances in the world can be completely overwhelming in relation to its effects on consciousness. We know that. We know that only too well. We're not dismissing that. But the Buddha is very, very clear. Buddhism is very clear. If you really want to change your life, you really are going to have to change consciousness. If you really are going to grow in the Dharma, you have to change consciousness, and you have to take responsibility for your mind and your mental states. It's really, really very important and again, it runs very counter to what's going on in the world today, which seems to be a very strongly blame culture and complaint culture, that suffering is explained entirely in terms of what is done externally to one. And of course we know suffering can be the effect, we can be hurt very badly by our external circumstances, but if you want to do anything about them, in the end you have to change consciousness. This was the great insight of Dr. Ambedkar very, very early on in the conversion movement, long before the conversion to Buddhism, actually. He had this realization, and you remember, this is a community suffering from terrible oppression, the untouched, so-called untouchables, as they were regarded in those days, that this realization that if there was going to be a change for his people, to use that expression, within Indian society itself, there needed to be a change of consciousness. There needed to be, in the end, a change of religion, because religion was having a very strongly conditioning effect on consciousness, as well as on politics and everything else. And everybody within that community needed to take responsibility for that. Extremely strong on that with his people. It's one of the reasons that I've gained an enormous amount of faith in the Dharma, seeing Dr. Ambedkar's emphasis on the transformation of consciousness, and that everybody needs to take responsibility for their consciousness. So it's very, very important that we make that central to our lives. If to the extent that we're blaming and fault-finding, to that extent that we're not really a Buddhist. We haven't understood the Buddha's teaching at all, to the extent that we're blaming, to the extent that we regard ourselves as a victim, to the extent that we're finding fault. Naropa's great saying, samsara is the tendency to find fault with others. So presumably nirvana is the complete opposite of that. Nirvana is the tendency to find quality in others, find find the best in others. So we really got to get hold of this. So mind training is tremendously important. We're going to need to reform our minds, change our consciousness, look into our consciousness if we really want to make any progress in the Dharma life, if we're going to move in the direction of the bodhicitta. We can't really sort of bang on about this enough. And I'm talking to myself as much as I'm talking to anybody else. So when I say you, I mean me. And then he gives the first thing about mind training. Of course, you notice meditation. This is why meditation is so important, because meditation is first and foremost a taking responsibility for ourselves, a taking responsibility for our consciousness. So that doesn't just happen on the cushion. That's got to happen off the cushion as well. You know, people are sometimes sort of surprised, you know, that they feel so miserable. And when you examine, you know, you ask them what they've been dwelling on in the previous days and weeks, it's usually quite negative mental states. And you have to sort of say, well, isn't there a sort of connection between that? Isn't your misery and so on something to do with what you've been dwelling on? You've been dwelling on quite negative things. Don't expect that you're going to feel very good about yourself. Don't expect to make much progress in meditation. You know, I've said this before, that mind in Buddhism runs very, very deep. The vision of consciousness, this is why the word mind isn't very good. Consciousness isn't very good either. The vision of mind is that it has tremendous depths. In the Yogacara, they talk about there being an alaya, a store consciousness, which is likened to a torrent or a river. It's constantly sort of changing. And what's going on with the alaya is that we're constantly seeding it or perfuming it with our different mental states and our different actions. So and they never get lost. It's a way of talking about karma and its effect, really. So if we're constantly sort of anxious, resentful, don't think that you're going to get away with that. Full of craving, addictive sort of stuff, that kind of thing. You can't get away with that. You can't cheat that. That's all depositing in the alaya. Similarly, you know, if you're entertaining metta in your mind, if you're being generous, if you're being clear and wise, if you're, you know, if you're being compassionate and so on and so forth, don't think that's not having an effect. It's the trouble, we often think that's not having any effect. It is. Every effort to make those states, that's also perfuming your alaya. People are very, very bothered about ecology these days and the environment externally. They pay very little attention to the ecology of mind. You know, every time we're entertaining unskillful states, we're pouring poisons into that deep consciousness. We're pouring, you know, we're really messing up the rivers of consciousness. Every time we're having metta and so on and so forth, we're cleaning that consciousness. So mind training, we've really got to take that very, very seriously. And I don't think we do. I don't think I take it anywhere seriously enough. Bhante used this image. He said he thought that We tend to sort of, you know, the way the British kind of are very stoical about the weather. You know, we put up with bad weather. He said he thought that that's what we do with our consciousness. We sort of put up with a sort of low-level negative weather, a low-level negative kind of weather in our consciousness, and, you know, just put up with it and don't do enough about it. That's having an effect. It's having an effect. It's leading to what's called dominasa. Sort of sadness, misery, sort of low-level negativity, grumpiness. But we can change that. You know, we can change that. That's the point. You know, we can get skillful, set up skillful habits. It's very important that we establish every day a regimen of practice. You know, sort of, just, okay, I'm going to do skillful things throughout this day. You know, we need to set those up so that the mind is changing, so that we're in this real mind, really training our minds, training our consciousness, training our heart. I think I'm going to stop there. I think that's probably enough ranting and raving for today. I think that's plenty to chew on. And tomorrow we'll get into the all these other teachings from Geshe Drom. We'll go through the different the root and branches of how to develop the two kinds of bodhicitta, starting with meditation on impermanence. Okay, thank you.